Good afternoon, San Marcos. Paul Wilson here for another episode of Philosophy and Popular Music. This is episode 2. You've just been listening to The Association with a song called Come On In. And it's very appropriate given what we're going to be talking about here today. My guest is founding and current member of The Association, Mr. Jules Alexander. How are you, Jules?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Well, so we're going to be speaking about, I titled this episode, Musical Arrangement, Aesthetics, and the Business of Music. I gave it a kind of a generic title there. But so what would you like to tell us about what arrangement is, what its significance is? What do you got for us today,
Jules? Well, a whole bunch of stuff, I hope. In music production, okay, recording, whatever, performing, writing, well, performing really, a recording, there is someone who says, you play this, you play that, you know, you and he or she writes or just hums it out or something, and so that's what arranging recording is, you know, it's the function of that person, you know, say, you do this, you do that. Right. It's very interesting because the arranger, his or her position in the production has changed from, say, well, 1900 to now, 100 years worth of thing. It's changed drastically from what it was.
Okay. What ways?
History. I have to go back to the history a little bit. In the early 1900s, what we heard, it was only performed. Of course, there weren't a lot of records around there. There wasn't any record radio. So we're talking about live performance, which was the nature of the music business, right? Was live performance. And it was also orchestral, you know, mostly. And who did the arranging was not necessarily the writer, although sometimes the writer did do the arranging in these pieces. You know, the writer generally would write the melody, and if there were lyrics, the lyrics. Sometimes there would be a lyricist, so on and so forth like that. But with 88 instruments, basically, in an orchestra, somebody has to say, okay, bass drum, do this.
Yeah.
And the arranger was not necessarily the lead person you would hear about, you know, in this sort of stuff like... let's take a little look, like Glenn Miller, okay?
Right.
In the 40s and 50s and 30s, Glenn Miller was a huge, huge name in the music business, and everybody knew the Glenn Miller Band. Oh, wow. You know, and the really good stuff. Well, Glenn didn't do any of his arranging, hardly.
Mm-hmm.
That was other people. And it was true with all of the bands.
Right.
Very few of the bands, the band leaders that got the promo and the name, didn't do the arranging. It was a separate person.
Right.
I'll focus on Glenn Miller because of his incredible popularity and the uniqueness of his sound, mm-hmm, compared to everything that was going out.
I see.
Glenn used several arrangers. He would hire the arranger, and the arranger would come up with the sound. It was the arranger's thing, and he settled on this fellow named Jerry Gray, was his main arranger, and he arranged songs like, well, before, now let me go a little further back, before Jerry came with Glenn, he was with Artie Shaw, and Artie Shaw had a band that was really artsy. He was very popular, but he wasn't very commercial. You know, his music was out there. It was unusual, and that was all. His unusualness was Jerry Gray, because he arranged for Artie Shaw. Glenn started getting popular and hired him away. He offered Jerry Gray more money. And Jerry said, yeah, okay, let's do it. In fact, it's very interesting. Glenn Miller was like... John Denver, okay? The John Denver of his day. That's how his music was perceived. Commercial, good, but nothing just really outstanding. But Artie Shaw was more like Frank Zappa of the day.
Okay.
Very, very progressive, so on and so forth like that. However, Artie Shaw had a couple of really big hits. that were arranged by Gray, okay, which one was called Begin the Begin, which was just this massive hit, and it was very unusual, just the chord structures and the tempos and so on and so forth. When Gray went with Glenn Miller, Gray's comment was, well, I like the music better with Artie Shaw, but I'm very comfortable with Glenn Miller.
Yeah.
And he went on to arrange some of the biggest songs ever. Pennsylvania 65,000, Chattanooga Choo Choo, Perfidia. These were big, huge hits in the 40s and 50s, you know. It was just amazing how that changed later on. In the 50s, the big bands were starting to go out because the music was changing. And the music was changing because the technology was changing. It followed along, just right along the way. There was this engineer who was a great guitar player. And he invented overdubbed music. Before that, there was only one track of music. You went and you played, and it all went down on one little track. That was it. It was pre-stereo. Stereo was part of the change. It was in the 50s. Mm-hmm. But in the early 50s, the technology was very simple. It was just recording basically what everybody played. You know, it would all be done at one time. There would be in almost every studio would have called an ISO booth, an isolation booth, mm-hmm. where the singer or singers would be in, or it could be several isolation booths, have the background singers in one, have the lead singer in another, excuse me, and the orchestra in one big room. It was just so you could separate those sounds mm-hmm. and balance them as you're recording, right. You know. As time went on, they got stereo, and all of a sudden you had two tracks. One track was on the left side, one track was on the right side. So you had two tracks, which offered the possibility of doing an instrumental on one track and the vocal on the other track, so you could completely separate them. It could give you a really, really fine balance. Along the early 50s, they started getting multi-tracks, three and four tracks. And, oh, my goodness, that changed everything. Also, with the decay of the big bands, excuse me a second.
Sure.
Boy, oh, there are just, these allergies are incredible. Man, not right now.
Okay.
The arranger in this, and as music was getting smaller, when I mean is smaller people, rock and roll was coming in. Mm-hmm. It was, they were finding out that you could record one person and a guitar and sell plenty of records on that.
Yeah.
So they did that. And the role of the arranger changed at that point.
Okay.
Because with the technology of recording, and this basically all came from recording, a person could go in and say, yes, I like this, I like that. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really need an arranger per se, because they were arranging their own stuff.
Right.
You know, the rock and roll bands, the country bands, you know. As time went on, the role of the arranger in pop music just almost went away, although it was there, because in pop music you would have, say, backgrounds, a horn chart behind it, violins. Somebody had to put those, tell them what to do. So the arranger would stick to that,
mm-hmm.
you know, in those early rock and roll pieces that had that kind of stuff in them. That's where the arranger went. So that role went farther and farther down, you know.
Joel, let me ask a question. So we're talking about the role of arranging as it pertains to writing and production,
yeah.
and so forth. But here's a question. Why wouldn't it have been the case for a composer or a team of composers to ordinarily think to themselves, "Oh, I hear a horn section here, and so I you know, why were arrangers more important when they were important, and why did that subside over time?" As you're saying,
yeah. Well, one of the reasons, like what you said just there, the mm-hmm. model you put up. If somebody say, "I would like to hear horns," let's get an arranger to put the horns in.
Okay.
Because the person who was saying might not be an arranger, might not know technically how to do it.
Okay.
You know, I mean, they might hear the sound and say, "Boy, it would sound great to have some horns here."
Yeah.
You know, I say, let's find somebody to do it. So the arranger's jobs got smaller. Instead of doing for the entire orchestra, which was about mm-hmm. gone at that point, you know, they would do a horn chart.
Mm-hmm.
Or a violin chart or a vocal chart. And the arrangers were always second tiered celebrities, okay?
Okay.
Or third or fourth tier. You know, like there's a famous jazz song called Take Five.
Okay. Brubeck.
Yeah, well, aha.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't Brubeck's arrangement. That was Paul Desmond's arrangement.
I see.
His horn player.
Okay.
Yeah. So Paul Desmond is another one of those incredible, incredible arrangers that arranged for him and arranged for all kinds of people, you know, all these incredible jazz charts, which the lead player just might not have those kind of chops to do that.
Yeah.
Although they might be an incredible player, and you could say, "Here, play to this," and they would just come up with magical stuff.
Yeah.
But the this that they would play to was done by the arranger.
Yeah.
You know. So there's two completely different disciplines is what they're doing there.
We're going to pause for some station identification type of stuff, and then we're going to come back to Philosophy and Popular Music with my guest, Jules Alexander. My name is Paul Wilson. Philosophy and Popular Music is sponsored in part by the Texas State University Department of Philosophy in affiliation with the Texas State University Philosophy Dialogue Series. Texas State University Department of Philosophy Dialogue Series, join the conversation. I'd also like to point out that the opinions expressed on this program are solely those of your host, yours truly, Paul Wilson, or of my guests today, Jules Alexander, and do not reflect those of KZSM Community Radio or its governing body, SMTX-CRA. And we're back. Philosophy and Popular Music. My name is Paul Wilson. I'm here with my friend Jules Alexander, and we're going to say hi to our friends Alan Forster, all the way over in Scotland. Hello, Alan. You just checked in to tell us we were loud and clear. And hello, Sharon Davis Green. Thank you for telling us that you're loving this interview. And we will continue with, I think Steve is queuing up some music for us. So Jules is going to be giving an example of the end result of arranging. And Jules, you want to tell us what we got coming up?
Yeah, I was talking about Glenn Miller, and this I want to show you just a pretty simple example, just a few bars of a tune. The first example is of Glenn Miller's version arranged by Jerry Gray of Perfidia. It's about eight bars. It's a song called Perfidia. Now, this is odd because Perfidia, of course, means faithlessness.
Mm.
Okay, and sometimes the arrangement does not reflect what the lyrics say. But I'll show you with these eight bars. This is Glenn Miller's version.
Okay,
Perfidia.
Fingers crossed.
Cries out perfidia, for I found you the love of my life in somebody else's arms.
Okay, that's Glenn Miller's version. Now, I did about a 5-minute arrangement just to show the difference. I changed it quite a bit, but it's the exact same melody. No lyrics on it, but you'll hear it.
Okay,
if we can play the second one. It's the second one.
Second clip.
It'll be here in a minute, I bet.
Thank you.
you can see how much an arrangement makes a difference in a tune.
So we went from a major to a minor key, for one thing.
No, it's a, no? It's the relative minor. Ah. Yeah, it's a, I think it's an E flat.
Okay.
The, the
okay.
next one, relative
okay.
minor.
Okay.
Exact same melody, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, an arrangement can make all the difference in a tune.
Well, let's talk next about how arrangement matters, is significant, is relevant for the business itself in terms of the money that a writer mm-hmm, makes mm-hmm, from a composition versus mm-hmm. the money an arranger makes for a composition. Mm-hmm. I should have reminded my friend Mike Byrne. My friend Mike Byrne told me long ago that in talking about arrangement, I don't have this queued up. I should have thought of it. But to take the song New York, New York, the Sinatra version, and that was the arranger. That was not part of the composition.
Yeah, that's the arrangement.
And that's the part that most people, or a lot of people at least, associate with
that
song.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about the arranging and the music business a little bit more as far as the payback and all that goes.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very interesting situation. An arrangement of a particular piece. First of all, let me. How can I get? I have to think about it in a different term. Who gets paid what? Okay, mm-hmm. And who? An arrangement is a derivative of the song.
Sure.
Technically, legally, what is a song? Mm-hmm. What you publish is the melody and the lyrics.
And that's
everything
it.
Else is arrangement. Everything
including,
else is arrangement.
Including chords that surround
chords, backgrounds, anything.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
So the arranger gets less money because if it wasn't for the song, there wouldn't be the arrangement.
Sure.
That's the argument.
Okay.
The other now that is also negotiable because the thing is, as you mentioned, people will remember the arrangement sometimes before the song.
Yeah.
I mean, the arrangement's all the hot little pieces, you know, the little things that grab your ear and go, ooh, ooh. Of course, the song also does that.
Right.
You know, if it's an incredibly good melody, so on and so forth like that. That's the arranger has second shrift, you know, in the whole shot. Excuse me. And that's the reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes that can be renegotiated, you know, in terms of payback. But that is just the way of it.
Can you think of any cases where that wasn't renegotiated? The arranger was able to or anything you've heard of, or
well, there's another aspect to this.
Okay.
Arrangements generally can't be copyrighted.
Right.
They can be registered, but not copyrighted.
Okay, and tell the listeners what that means.
if a piece of music is registered, that means it goes down in the Library of Congress as, you know, it's registered that person did that arrangement.
Gotcha.
Okay. If you publish a song, that goes down in the Library of Congress as the writer.
Okay.
Of the melody.
Okay.
And the lyrics, which may be two people or three or four people, on and on like that. But that's how they go. That's how it goes.
Okay.
I honestly can't think of anything, a renegotiation, but.
But in theory, it's happened, or at least in theory, it could happen.
Yeah. There's another thing that happened. I'll go back to Glenn Miller. Glenn Miller. It was before the Second World War when all these songs, or right at the beginning, came out, and he got really hot then. He joined the Air Force right away.
Okay.
And he was, of course, put in the Air Force band, but as the head of the music and so on and so forth. Well, what he did is he talked to Jerry Gray and got him to join the Air Force and got him to be his arranger in the Air Force. Yeah, so that type of thing happens. If you do an arrangement, if a person does an arrangement and it really knocks you out, you go back to that person and back.
Sure.
And then they will negotiate more, you know, more of a payback than just the standard fee, whatever it would be.
But typically, an arranger would just get a one-time-only fee. Whereas the writer, now a writer of a hit song will get what? Tell us about the business.
Well, the writer of the hit song publishes it, and the laws of that have just changed recently. But what it is, the writer is given a percentage or a royalty It used to be for, I think, 40 years, 40 or 50 years. I can't remember offhand. But now it goes on ad infinitum somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. It really goes on forever.
Okay.
But you have to, you know, go after it, so on and so forth.
Okay.
But it's there. You know, okay. Yeah, that changed just recently thanks to the Turtles. The
really?
Rock and roll band who sued a record company and won, you know.
Oh.
The guy, yeah, Turtles did that.
Okay.
So that's what happens.
I see.
And the singer of the song, unless they're the writer, they don't get anything unless they've made the deal with the writer, which happens.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot. In fact, if a very popular singer, let's say Beyonce, wants to do a tune or is suggested and she likes it, she can go to the writer and say, look, I'm going to sell a billion records no matter whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. So you're going to make a lot of money, so I want a piece of yours. And that happens.
Okay.
I know when the association signed with a publishing company, we signed with Beachwood Music mm-hmm. back when we were first starting.
Right.
Well, there are six writers in the band, okay? And our manager went to Beachwood and said, look, the standard deal at the time was 50-50. If you sell, you know, if you get 50 cents off a record, the writer would get 50 cents, the publishing company would get 50 cents. This is publishing fees, which are not record sales fees. Well,
right.
That's another story. But our manager went to the publishing company and said, look, you're getting six writers here. We're not going to sign that. It says we want half of your 25%. Their half. And Beachwood agreed.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the beginning of different negotiations. That was in 1965.
Yeah. And what happened essentially with that is that whether you wrote a tune or Terry or Russ or whoever, you each of the band members would get some percentage
split six
of that.
Ways, six ways, okay. Because the argument on our side is, hey, if it wasn't for us out there singing it, you wouldn't have it, you know, and it's a fair argument, so, yeah.
All right.
And now, as times has changed so much, the technology has changed massively since the 60s and mm-hmm. since the record business was basically selling these things, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that anymore.
Okay.
And technology has gotten so good, just about anybody can make a good-sounding record. So the record companies are now not so much music-making companies, but distribution companies. They distribute. And that's even changing because CDs are no longer what they were, which is what records were.
Right.
Now there's more downloads than CDs.
Yeah.
So their importance is even dropping even farther. You know. And now the actual maker of the record, the musician, if the musician wants to, and now they actually have to, we have to do this, we have to be the record company, which is great because we get paid more, you know. So
yeah, paid more per unit, but perhaps would.
But the unit is a download now, as opposed to you'll take CDs to the gig and so on and so forth, or download wristbands or something, you know. But it's kind of neat because this puts the maker of the music in charge as opposed to a record company, which may not like what the musician's doing, you know, so they wouldn't distribute it, where the musician can say, hey, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the way it works now. Yeah.
So the musician has more control over that.
Way more.
But the challenge would be to match the sales that Warner Brothers or Columbia or one of these big labels could do at the time up until the last 20 years or
whatever. Yes, exactly.
Since the decline of since the advent of streaming radio and the decline of that whole aspect of the business.
Well, the streaming radio, but still you can do that, though. That can be done, you know.
I'm going to pause once more for my little underwriting blurb. And Steve and I, what we realized last week is that we didn't really get a good recording of me saying this. So I am hopeful that I will do a good job at least one of the three times that I say it this time. You are listening to Philosophy and Popular Music with Paul Wilson.
Philosophy and Popular Music is sponsored in part by the Texas State University Department of Philosophy in affiliation with the Philosophy Dialogue Series. Join the conversation. I'm here with my friend Jules Alexander of the Association. We're talking about the significance of arrangement in the music business, the significance of the aesthetics of musical arrangement. And we're back with Philosophy and Popular Music. My name is Paul Wilson. I'm here with Jules Alexander. Jules, where were we? Shall we continue our conversation?
We were in San Marcos.
We were in San Marcos. We're looking out on Guadalupe Street. We've hopefully got a few listeners. My father just... I have 13 listeners. Wonderful. I just got a text from my father. Paul, I tried to listen to your radio broadcast, but I couldn't get it to work. Do I need to download something to my phone for it to work? Pop, I'll get with you after I'm done here. I'm sorry. KZSM.org. Well, if he can't hear it, he can't hear it. KZSM. Yeah, I'll do that. I don't know if you'll... I'll text Dad later, but, you know, I am at the... Oh yes, and Alan Forster is telling us nice with the perfidy eclipse. Okay, well let's continue with our conversation now that we've said hello to people that are listening or trying to listen. Where were we? We were talking about
music. Well, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
What Thelonious Monk said about music is talking about music is like dancing about architecture.
Well, I'm going to try it by go.
I know, me too. We were talking about who gets paid what.
Yes,
and
okay.
The way technology has changed, that's what I was trying to lead into in my own way. And technology now makes it possible for anybody to basically be their own record company. You can really do it. There's a lot of information out there, you know, about how to do it, and it takes very little research to find. It's not new ground anymore. This geography of the music business is well trod.
Okay.
So it's also well documented.
Okay.
All you have to do is look on the internet, and you can find a lot of things. You know, a lot of ways how to do that.
Well, this is the part of the show, if I'm doing these little hour segments, and I guess maybe for some of these shows I'm going to do 2-hour segments, but last week it worked out pretty well. I had John and Bill do their background, and then we tried to get a little philosophical. Let's pose this question to you, Jules.
Okay.
Let's talk about the ethics of the music business with respect to arrangement. What do you think is can we make a case for what's a fair way that the arranger should be compensated? What should the role of the arranger be more prominent? Have they been shortchanged over the years? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I it's really hard to say. I think the role has changed definitely. You know, the actual arranging task, you know, has changed. Like now the technology is so different that you throw a loop on and that's the arrangement.
Right.
But it's just so different.
Well, let's take the example of like Glenn Miller's arranger.
Okay,
should there have, at the time when arrangers were really serving that kind of function for those kinds of songs, do you think that they were unsung heroes, or that they should have gotten more credit?
You know? They had a higher profile than later on in the 50s.
I see. Okay,
they had a much higher profile.
Okay.
And they were very valuable.
So they would be named musicians along with the writer as well as the performer.
Yes, in fact, on sheet music, every now and then you look at sheet music.
Yeah.
Say, written by so and so forth, arranged by.
Right.
Da, da, da.
Okay.
You know, they would definitely get. They would get that.
Okay.
You know, they would get that, which would give them plenty of work.
Okay.
You know.
So they'd get more work from a hit arrangement, but they wouldn't necessarily get. Repeat. They wouldn't get.
Yeah, they would get repeat, but they would get no royalties.
Right. Okay.
No, the royalties go elsewhere.
Okay.
Because again, the arrangement is derivative of the song.
Sure. Okay.
You know? So.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It's like a painter goes in to paint a house, and he makes a few bucks and goes on, and the house is there, and you sell the house again, and you don't sell the paint job again.
Yeah. Know? Okay. Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a yeah.
Okay. Well, what about I played a song. I'm just going to go ahead and do this since we're kind of fishing for things to
to say. Okay, so I played this. I played a song at the very beginning of the hour, and the song was called "Come On In," and the association did a version of it.
By Joe Mapes.
By Joe Mapes. Okay, so I don't know if all of you are paying attention at the beginning of the hour. I'm gonna play a very different arrangement, and Jules can only speak maybe to the association arrangement, but here's just another example of a very different arrangement of the same song. In fact, tempo is different, the key is different, the vocal arrangements are different. Let's let this one play. This is the same song done by the Monkees. Peter Tork is singing lead vocal on this.
Come on in. You sure look good to me. Come on in. I've learned how lonely I can be. I guess we'll went wrong. You know it's been a whole year has passed us by and gone, but we're back together now where we belong. So baby, come on in.
Yeah, so in that case we have not only the down tempo kind of halftime thing, and then he picks up the beat in the B section, I guess, if it were. So here's a question. You know, this perhaps might be something that would be easier to speak to than the Joe Mapes song that we're talking about now. So let's talk about songs that the demos were very different than the hit arrangements might have been. But maybe like Wendy by Ruth Ann Friedman.
Well, before I say that, okay. I want to say something about this particular song.
Yeah, sure.
The song Come On In, we knew the Monkees. They were friends of ours, sort of. And the producer of the Monkees, Chip Douglas.
Sure.
Okay. Was in a band called the Modern Folk Quartet.
Mm-hmm.
The Modern Folk Quartet did the first version of this Come On In.
Oh, I didn't know that.
yeah.
Okay.
And Chip arranged it.
Okay.
Okay. And we heard it from the MFQ.
Yeah.
And he produced the Monkees.
Yeah.
I don't think he produced this one. Does not sound like Chip's.
I think it might have been Peter Tork's. This was an unreleased song. It didn't appear on one of their albums.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
I just had them there for the contrast. You know, I just thought that would be good.
Yeah, you're right.
Anyway, so.
There's a good contrast.
Exactly.
So what did you ask me?
My question after the Joe Mapes song was, so songs that an artist or a band receives from a demo and the versions that becomes a hit becomes very different. So what could you tell us maybe about Ruth Ann Friedman's version of Wendy, the demo versus the hit song? How?
Yeah, well, Ruth Ann was a dear friend of ours. I still know her. We still talk. Yeah. She's great. She lives in L.A.
Yeah. I met her at the deal last year.
Yeah, you met her at that deal. Yeah. Well, Ruth Ann brought that song to our manager, said, "Look, I want to show you." Took Wendy, okay. Mm-hmm. She brought that song to him, and he said, "Look, I like the song. However, her demo, okay, which was just her and guitar, but he says I think you should speed it up, do this, do that, and it changed it, and all of a sudden, wham! You know, he was right. He was right. So." We did a different version than she put, okay?
Okay.
Now, generally, if you hear a demo, if you're looking for a demo to do something and somebody gives you a demo, I've seen this happen time and time again. The artist will do something like that demo because that demo is what got him.
Sure.
You know, or her.
Yeah.
You know, and so they will kind of stick with that demo unless they hear a completely different thing, you know, and, mm-hmm. and they'll do a different thing. You'll hear that in people that cover songs sometimes. They'll own the song differently than the original song.
Okay.
You know, they'll just do a whole different thing on it, which is great. But that's a slightly different version, doing a cover of a song, but it's like doing a cover of a demo.
Yeah.
You know, because something is in that demo that you liked. And that was the truth was Along Comes Mary, that first hit we had.
Okay.
I was called in to do that demo. This publishing company said, listen, we need demos and come play guitar. I was being a studio guitar player at the time. So I went in, I did the demo and heard the song. And I said, we want it. Right. I want it for our band. Would you give it to us? And they said, yeah, okay, go ahead, take it.
Yeah.
So the actual record is not that different from the demo.
Okay.
It's just enhanced with better
and
drums.
And it's got your vocal arrangement.
And it's got my vocal arrangement. Yeah. Of course. Well.
Yeah, but the tempo and the groove and
the whole groove, and the chord structure. the feel, the thing, you know, that was there.
Okay.
You know, it came across in the demo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. We're back here in the last quarter hour of my second episode of Philosophy and Popular Music. My name is Paul Wilson. Why am I doing this show? Well, my name is Paul Wilson, as I said, and I am a senior lecturer in philosophy at the Texas State University Philosophy Department. I'm also a semi-professional musician. I play in bands locally. I will sometimes sub in the band that Jules founded and performs with, the Association. I've gotten the honor to play with those guys. So I thought it was very appropriate that I sort of merge the two careers that I'm pursuing and have been loving and enjoying all of my adult life, pretty much. And so I'm very fortunate to have my friend Steve Jones here, a KZSM volunteer who's been helping me with the program. And I very, very, very much appreciate you, what you're helping with, Steve. I appreciate you helping me get off the ground. I want to thank the members of my department, Craig Hanks, Camry Pipper Smith, and the department for helping me. And I want to thank all my guests that have spoke. Last week we had John Inman and Bill Sterrett, and we're going to do an encore broadcast of last week's show. So if you want to learn about lead guitar and the creative process, that'll be playing from 4 to 5. I think the audio for this broadcast might be a bit more up to snuff. I think I wasn't really on the mic last time. So if you can't hear as well in the next broadcast, which is the encore performance of last week, it's all my fault because I was not on mic. But here in the last 15 minutes, I'm here with my friend Jules Alexander, who is one of the founding members and current member of the Association, pop rock band that has been in existence since 1965. They're celebrating their 55th anniversary. Jules, our friend Paul Beach, who is also an associate back in the 80s. Paul Beach has texted in and said, how about discussing the role and evolution of the producer, as well as the... How the producer figures into the arranging. Let's talk some about that.
Okay, when we say the producer, we're talking about record production. And the producer is a very important aspect of a recording. The producer is a guy that puts the whole thing together. Mm-hmm. Said, let's say the band wants to do a record, or anybody wants to record something good. Unless you know what you're doing, you need a producer who does this, who records. The producer is responsible. Actually, they're pretty responsible for everything. Getting on the tape, that was yesterday's work. Getting in the grooves, that's even before the tape. You know, but for everything that's recorded, the quality of it, the length, He will be the person that interfaces oftentimes with a record company or a distributing company, so on and so forth. The producer's version has changed over the years also because the marketing has changed. And this has been in the last 20 years. It's just really changed a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But the producer is a guy, let's say you want a horn section, he hires them. He does it or she does it, you know, whoever is doing the producer. There's also the engineer, who is may or may not be the producer. Generally, it's two different things.
Right.
The engineer is the person who's back there tweaking all the knobs and making sure it is being recorded properly.
Right.
And that's incredibly valuable. Each one has an absolutely a must be there situation. And the producer is oftentimes more responsible then the act itself, whoever's recording for the final sound, because We had a producer for, well, we've had a number of producers. We were lucky enough to have a guy named Bones Howe produce us, produce a couple of big hits. And it said he was the best ears in the music business.
Yeah.
He could just hear things. He said, oh, there's a little click on 19, you know, bar 19, you know, track 62, you know, and you didn't hear it. But when he would take it out, take out a little click, you would hear it then.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Gone. It's amazing. This yeah. guy, it's just... he could hear harmonies. We could take our harmonies in that we had worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would say, you got something funny on this one thing. He said, try this. And just little tweaks.
Yeah.
And just all of a sudden, woo, yeah, he would do that.
And Bones was a drummer, actually, wasn't he?
He started out as a drummer, yeah. But then it went on into production.
Yeah.
But that the Ranger does the same thing
yeah.
also. But
okay.
he the producers in the... In the control booth, he isn't out there with the people recording. He's
yeah.
there with the engineer,
right?
You know, Bones happened to be a real good engineer too,
mm-hmm.
but at least he knew engineering, so he could speak
yeah.
to the engineer. He talked electronics,
yeah.
You know, now you have to speak binary, you know,
right? Right.
But it works, you know.
Well, so Jules, let's in our closing minutes here, give us your personal philosophy about the business and the relationship, the role of arranging and where it's going in the business. What do you think about the future?
Well,
any thoughts on that? Yeah,
I can't tell where it's going, but the technology is getting better and it's going to change again. I guarantee you.
Yeah.
In the next 5 or 10 years, you're not going to even recognize what was going on back here.
Okay.
It's going faster and faster and faster. It's interesting because all the musicians are evolving also.
Okay.
And it's going to come from the musicians
yeah.
and the writer. That's where it's going to come from. Technology is really really been responsible for a lot of what you hear on the radio because it's so simple to do good recordings now. I
mm-hmm.
mean, top of the line stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that open, you don't have to worry so much about the technical anymore. It used to be the worry is, were you getting a good sound? You can get a good sound, you know, spitting, you know, with the technology
yeah.
nowadays.
Yeah.
I've got a little tiny studio, and it's as good. It, you know, it costs, I don't know, maybe $5,000 worth of stuff. But it's as good as the $100,000, $500,000 studios were in the 60s.
Yeah.
It's really.
Oh, wow.
And it's just this funky little couple of computers and a couple
yeah.
of really good speakers and a
yeah.
really good mic, but it's all digital now.
Right.
So it's almost impossible. I have no idea where it's going to go. I think it might get a little more melodic again. I'm not sure. It's gone from orchestra to small. To smaller, fewer people involved, you know, because of the technology,
right.
You can do so much. I think it's going to expand a little bit now.
Okay.
In the next 5 or 10 years, I think it's going to get bigger. I think it's going to get more melodic. That's what I think.
Okay. Well, I have a couple more songs I thought of it as far as very different arrangements. Maybe we can.
Yeah.
I thought the ones that I thought of would be let's try this one. I guess this is the disco version. Is it the disco version? Of course it is. And only because I'm thinking of this off the cuff. We're going to start with this one. Okay, so we you know, Steve Jones does a program during the week called The Hustle, where he talks about the music business. So he talks about similar topics as mine, but the theme song of his show is The Hustle by Van McCoy. So we've got one from about the same era. This is the disco version of Knock on Wood, done by Amy Stewart. Okay, so we'll play that, and then we'll play the original classic, just so we can again see how arrangement. How the outcome of different arrangements. Let's start with this one.
I'm sure.
KZSM.org. I've been here with my friend Jules Alexander. Jules, got a road date this weekend?
Yeah, going to Tonawanda, New York, which is just outside of Buffalo.
Do you know the name of the venue off the top of your head?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, look on www.theassociationwebsite.com if you're in New York or in the New England or nearby and want to go see the guys play. They'll be playing this Saturday. Pronounce that for me again.
Tonawanda, New York.
I can't say that. Jules, thank you so much for being my guest.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for the invite.
You bet. And everyone, have a great afternoon, and we'll see you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.